The Maine State Prison is in the national spotlight as it works to reform its policy on solitary confinement. In 2014, the use of solitary confinement at the Maine State Prison in Warren was the subject of a PBS Frontline documentary. The film was part of a national conversation about the common practice of isolating certain inmates, sometimes for 23 hours a day, sometimes for weeks or months at a time. Now, 3 years later, a new Frontline documentary explores the impact of solitary confinement on prisoners and examines changes the Maine State Prison is adopting. I'm Jennifer Rooks, today on Maine Calling, the use of solitary confinement. Why is it used? What psychological effects does it have on prisoners? And are there better options for handling violent and unpredictable felons? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For most of us, it's just about impossible to imagine being locked in a prison cell for 23 hours a day, 7 days a week. But in many prisons, solitary confinement is an accepted means to punish prisoners and keep prison staff safe. The effects, however, of this isolation can be devastating. The Maine State Prison is leading an effort to reduce its use of solitary confinement. With me in the studio today, Ryan Thornell. He is Associate Commissioner of the Maine Department of Corrections. Joseph Jackson is a former prisoner and now coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. And on the line with us from Oxford, England, Dan Edge. In 2014, he produced and directed two documentaries for the PBS program Frontline that explored America's reliance on incarceration. His latest documentary, which you can see on Maine Public Television next Tuesday, April 18th, explores the controversial practice of solitary confinement and is called Last Days of Solitary. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you think solitary confinement is an acceptable way of dealing with some prisoners? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We're going to start by listening to a clip of the film, and here a psychiatrist talks about the origins of the whole idea of solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement has the most fascinating history in the United States. The United States was actually the leader in modern times of introducing solitary confinement to the world. It was actually introduced by the Quakers as a noble experiment in rehabilitation. There was a belief that you could put a prisoner in his own solitary cell, freed from the evil influences of modern society. And if you put them in that cell, they would become like a penitent monk, free to come close to God and to their own inner being, and they would naturally heal from the evils of the outside society. It was a noble experiment, and it was an absolute catastrophe.
Dan Edge, thanks so much for being here or being in Oxford studio, Oxford, England, and talking to us. Since this Quaker experiment, how common has solitary confinement become in American prisons?
Well, it was almost unused, actually, for much of the 20th century. And then it really took off as a technique, something to use in American prisons in the sort of 1970s and then mushroomed in the 1980s. Until by the time you reach the 1990s, in many prisons, it had become the sort of go-to solution to almost any problem that a prison could face. So many mentally ill people would end up in segregation. Many inmates who are difficult to manage for other reasons. Many inmates who needed protection from other inmates when in segregation. So it's not, as we might imagine, the worst of the worst, if you like, the most dangerous psychopathic inmates who were filling up the solitary cells in the 1990s and then early 2000s. It was a very wide range of inmates until this century. Estimates are between sort of 80, 90, 100,000 inmates across the United States in solitary, which is really sort of unprecedented across the world. Now, as our film sort of really digs into, and especially in Maine, this is completely changing.
Ryan, tell me about your career in corrections and how common segregation or solitary confinement was when you got started working in this, and how the thinking about it has changed.
Well, I think that the thinking about it has changed drastically, especially in the state of Maine. As you look across the national landscape, you know, over the last 10 or so years, in my experiences in different departments, the use of restrictive housing has really been a go-to response to different behaviors. And I think that if you look historically in Maine, you would see that as well, speaking to Dan's point. But the change has really taken place nationally in the last 2 years or so. And, you know, when you go to gatherings with colleagues from across the nation, you can start seeing a change in mentality, a change in perspective with corrections officials that is starting to come in line with where Maine has been over the last couple of years. There's certainly still states that have the mentality that solitary confinement is a go-to solution. It's sort of an easy way to deal with problem inmates. But there's certainly a wave that's coming across the nation that is changing that.
Joe, I want to bring you into the conversation because this is a personal issue for you. It's not just your advocacy work. You have experienced solitary confinement. What is important for people to understand about it?
Well, I think one of the things that you understand about it is it is state-sponsored trauma, and that that most of the people that ended up there were not the most violent as even was first asserted when the place was built. The other thing is that the reason that in Maine that we moved away from solitary confinement is because of a group like Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition, who when we formed, we were Mainers against solitary confinement. At the time, there was 100 beds that were associated with solitary confinement in Maine. So,
Joe, when was it? When were you formed?
We were formed in 2007.
So, okay.
And so now, you know, while that is down, it is because that of outside pressure that from advocates from the outside that actually spurred this change.
I understand that because most people don't know what goes on inside prison walls.
That is correct.
Did you find that when you first started talking about this, people just almost didn't know what you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it took a lot of effort because I'm one of the founders of the Maine State Prison branch of the NAACP. So we were actually had to fight to get legislators to come in to interview prisoners who were there in solitary confinement and raise the awareness that this was a problem, that we were just sending people there, you know, sometimes for smiling.
I thought it was interesting what you said, Dan, that often solitary confinement was used to protect the person who was put into solitary confinement. I hadn't thought of it that way, but as you said that, I thought that makes sense.
Yeah, and I met inmates when I was there filming back in 2013, 2014, who deliberately got themselves put in solitary confinement because they were frightened in general prison population. So, and this is what was really fascinating for us when we started out on this project, is that there's no one solution for a prison management that has decided to try and cut down on its use of segregation, because there's multiple different reasons why people end up there. So you have very dangerous inmates, you have mentally ill inmates, you have inmates who are there for their own protection, you have inmates who are simply disruptive, and each of them requires a different sort of set of program solutions to try and move away from using solitary.
Ryan, Dan used the phrase cut down on the use of solitary confinement. That has happened at the Maine State Prison very dramatically, hasn't it?
Yeah, so in my time there, I've been overseeing the unit for the last 20 months or so, and when we began this latest round of reforms, we started with a 50-bed unit that was full on any given day with all of the types of inmates that Dan just described. And I can say today we're down to 7 inmates placed in restrictive housing, and we've actually physically moved the special management unit from a 50-bed unit into 2 distinct 16-bed units, giving us 32 beds total. And on any given day, we have many more vacancies than we have occupied cells.
And you say, again, Dan used the phrase cut down. Does this mean that you want to reduce, but you don't believe it's realistic to eliminate the use of segregation completely?
Certainly. You know, I think that down in the single digits is the realistic population that we're going to have in a special management unit, because we're always going to have prisoners who need some period of time out of general population because of the threat that they're posing for whatever they're doing. So I certainly do not think that the goal is to shut down the unit, because we'll always have that need. However, I think we can operate the unit in a way that prevents long-term use of restrictive housing. So we have inmates placed there who need to be there for a short period of time. We provide them with the stability, the programming, the behavioral change components that they need. We remove them from the population for a period of time, and then we get them back out to the population as quickly as we can. And at the same time, we give the correctional officers and staff the tools to manage them appropriately once they're transitioned back, realizing they're not going to stay in restrictive housing for a long period of time.
Joe, I assume you've been watching these changes very closely. What's your response to them?
Well, no, I think that it's wonderful that they have reduced it as much. And the last time I was there, there were 8 people. So I applaud that. The department has moved in that direction, and including the fact that the place is now clean. There seems to be more things for those prisoners to do while they're there than before. And so, yeah, we're pleased, but we definitely would like to see the use of solitary confinement not only reduced further, but definitely that length of time that people stay there. That's something that always has to be monitored.
Okay, well, we're going to go back to the film. This is a clip from a prisoner who is really one of the central characters in the film, if you will. His name's Sam, is it Kaysen? Is that pronouncing it
right? That's
right. And he's in prison for assault.
The first time I got in trouble, I got sent to a mental hospital. And then I got sent to a juvenile facility for a year. I spent 9 months in SEG by myself when I was 16. That was the worst, you know, it was torture pretty much. I would bang my head on doors, cut myself, pretty much anything I wasn't supposed to do that I could do with the very little bit I had in myself.
Dan, your first film was very dramatic and showed some of this self-harm. And as I listened just to that clip, 16 years old, 9 months, I can't even imagine what the long-term impact is on somebody at such an important time in their development.
No, I mean, I'm sure it's profound. Obviously, these are often inmates, individuals who are already quite damaged. They've already come from difficult traumatic backgrounds, and it's almost impossible to disentangle the effects of solitary confinement specifically. But it's clearly profound. I want to make it clear with Samuel Kaysen's instance, what he's talking about there is a long time in the past, and none of this happened in Maine recently. This is sort of in the late 90s, early 2000s. He, for the almost the entire period we were filming in Maine State Prison, Samuel Kaysen was in general population. So in a way, his story is emblematic of the changes that have happened nationwide and in Maine. But it's also true to say that when we first started filming in Maine in 2013, although the reforms which had been started by the previous commissioner, Joseph Pont, were well underway and the use of solitary had been cut down, there was, as our film showed, really, a sort of epidemic of self-harm in the prison, particularly in that unit. And one of the things, to be quite honest, it's been very pleasing to be able to chart in the new documentary is how the prison has effectively tackled that. I mean, Ryan will have the latest statistics, but the prevalence, self-harm, as I understand it, almost disappeared in the solitary unit in the prison now. And I mean, there was a lot of it when we were there in 2013.
Ryan, do you want to follow up?
Certainly. Dan's exactly right. The self-injurious behavior that we see today is few and far between. Certainly not anything like you'll see in the film that when it replays from the 2013-2014 coverage, a drastic decrease. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. You know, the first thing I would say is we introduced a new way, really, of communicating with inmates. And so staff, correctional officers specifically, receive training on effective communication strategies in order to help de-escalate situations instead of escalate situations. And so that has had a tremendous impact. And I think more recently, as Joe Jackson pointed out, the environment has changed in restrictive housing. We've moved them into a housing unit that is clean. It has bright lighting. It has adequate space to move around. We are able to get them out of their cells frequently in a controlled manner. We're able to have them socialize with each other in a controlled setting that cuts down on the time that they have to sit in their cell and think about self-harm. And we've also increased our multidisciplinary approach to how we deal with inmates. And so we have mental health services and medical services, trained program staff accessible to these inmates on a regular basis, reviewing cases on a regular basis. And so we've really taken a multitude of strategies and thrown them at this effort in order to cut down and then keep down the incidence of self-harm and other behaviors.
So, Joe, let me play the contrarian a little bit. What if someone's listening to this program and says right now, why should I care about these people? They've done terrible things to be in prison.
Well, one is, I think that you should care about because about 90% of the people who are incarcerated are going to be released. And then, and how do we want them to be released? Do we want to make them worse and then let out a much worse person? Or there's been a statement that says that sometimes prisons are creating criminals. And so if we're doing that, then no. I mean, I think that we should be caring about how this is happening. And I also want to add one thing that Ron said is that the commissioner did do something that was really poignant for me in about the solitary confinement and with self-harm, is that there was once a policy that also disciplined you as though if you self-harm, you got 30 more days in solitary every time you did it. And so you can get that time racked up, you know, really fast, especially for a mentally ill kid. And so Commissioner Fitzpatrick did away with the policy that disciplined people for doing that self-harm, and I really had to applaud him for that.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about solitary confinement and some of the reforms underway at the Maine State Prison and a new Frontline documentary that will air on Maine Public Television Tuesday night. When we come back, we'll hear a little more from the film. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine General Health, offering a physician referral and health information line at 1-855-4-MGH-INFO.
Did you ever wonder where we come from and where we're going?
I think we already are a different species. We've supersized our diets. We have eradicated certain diseases. We're putting more data into our brains in one day than we used to put in a lifetime.
I'm Guy Raz, the source of everything, our origins and our future. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock and again Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants to restart the harsh and costly drug war first launched in the 30s by drug czar Harry Anslinger.
The Treasury Department intends to pursue a relentless warfare against the despicable, dope-peddling vulture who preys on the weakness of his fellow man.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Join us Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, why Maine State Prison is reducing its use of solitary confinement. With me in the studio, Joseph Jackson, a former prisoner and now coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. Ryan Thornell is Associate Commissioner of the Maine Department of Corrections. On the line with us from Oxford, England, Dan Edge. In 2014, he produced and directed two documentaries for the PBS program Frontline that explored America's reliance on incarceration. His latest documentary, which you can see on Maine Public Television April 18th, explores the controversial practice of solitary confinement and is called Last Days of Solitary. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to hear another bit from the clip. This is, again, prisoner Samuel Kaysen.
You're not the same after spending so much time by yourself in those conditions. I don't care who you are. You don't come out the same person. I did 11 months in a SAG unit and went from there straight home. I tried to tell my mom and everybody I didn't want anybody around, and I got home, there was 5 people there, and I felt like there was 5,000 people there. And ultimately, for my first couple months, I locked myself in my camper until my mom and everybody tried to explain to me, I'm not in prison. I shouldn't live like that. I ultimately tried to force myself to live like I was still in SAG because I didn't know what to do. And then when I stopped, I was out of control. I didn't know what to do with myself. I went from the most restrictive place I've ever been to no restrictions at all. And ultimately, I ended up shooting somebody and coming back.
Dan Edge, I know you need to go in just a couple minutes and finish your work on the documentary, but I want to ask you, before we say goodbye, what do you hope that people learn from this film, come away with from watching the film?
I think the two main things. Firstly, and it's quite a positive message, really, is that change is possible. I think what we witnessed over the 3.5 years of our reporting in Maine State Prison and outside with inmates who left was a real change taking place within the prison, and a change for the better for the inmates, for the officers that worked there, but also quite clearly for society, because what we realized very quickly when we started filming in 2013 is that segregation, solitary confinement, damages people. It damages them. And as Joseph said a few minutes ago, most of these guys are getting out. So, you know, collectively, I think what the film explores is that collectively we have to make a decision about what prisons are for. Are they there to simply punish people, to lay punishment upon punishment? Or are they there to do something else? Are they there to make everyone else safer? And if they're there to make us safer, then in theory people need to be less dangerous when they come out than they were when they went in. And solitary confinement doesn't achieve that aim. That much is very clear from our reporting and is made very clear in the film. That sounds bleak, of course, but what makes this, I think, believe ultimately a hopeful film is what the Maine State Prison has achieved while we've been documenting them. And the fact that other prisons across the country now are following suit, are trying to do the similar thing. I think more than 30 states are now experimenting with one form or another of solitary reform. So ultimately, I think our film is a hopeful one.
Well, Dan Edge, thank you so much for taking time out of your editing. I know it's going to be a very long few days for you, but we look forward to seeing the film on Tuesday night on PBS. Dan Edge is producer and director of Frontline's documentaries, Solitary Nation, Prison State, and Last Days of Solitary.
Thank you so much.
I want to talk about something Dan said, which is this overall maybe a change in philosophy of what prison's for. Is that, did he hit the nail on the head with something? Is this a different way of thinking about why we even have prisons?
Well, I think that certainly in Maine, that is what we've experienced. And I think a lot of credit goes to our current commissioner, Dr. Joe Fitzpatrick, who has really set the tone for our department of one of programming and rehabilitation versus any sort of punishment or institutionalization. And so I think that what you see as you go through our facilities, hopefully what you see and experience would be an emphasis on addressing, you know, the root causes of criminal behavior, stabilizing you know, destabilized prisoners and then effectively working them towards a safer and a more proper reintegration into the community. And I think that if, you know, you can look simply at what we do in restrictive housing and see that emphasis, you know, it, as prisoner Jason Potter spoke about it in the article that came out today, in our restrictive housing setting, we have introduced a level system that encourages inmates to come out of their cell initially with restraints and eventually without restraints around other inmates in restrictive housing so they can socialize together before they even transition out to general population. And really the reason for that is we want them to effectively transition out to general population and then transition back to the community so they don't go through experiences like Sam Kaysen highlighted in this clip.
We have a tweet from Robert. The moral gymnastics regarding solitary confinement is anything but cruel and unusual, defines our current criminal injustice system. Joseph, is this conversation about solitary confinement a small part of a bigger discussion about how many people are incarcerated in America today?
Yes, I was thinking that your question prior to is this a new way of thinking about why we are incarcerating. We haven't even started to think about why we are incarcerating people. If you ask me, we are still inflicting trauma on all of those, whether they're in solitary confinement or not, and that the majority of people that get out feel like the guy did, didn't know what to do, and feels lost after a while. And so that's the state that they are in. And so, no, we have a long way to go when it comes to that, and rethinking a prison and rethinking about the what we're doing to people. So, yes. And lastly, I want to think about, we really need to think about what it means is when we destroy someone's life and whose responsibility is to pick it back up. Did they destroy it themselves? But how can that be when once a person is labeled a criminal, they're labeled for life and must check boxes in employment, must be restricted from housing? These things are lifelong, life-lasting. And so, yeah, we really have to rethink the way we not only do prison, our justice system. 70% of them people inside are mentally ill. Have been just a recent article on Saturday. All inmates in county jails have mental diagnoses. The majority of prisoners have addiction issues associated with their crimes. And so what we have done is we've criminalized addiction. Many of the people that found themselves in solitary confinement were finding themselves in solitary confinement for their addiction issue. So these are things that I think that we still struggle with, that the prison still struggles with. But, I mean, not to say they're making strides forward, but there's a lot of work to do.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there, Jennifer. Nice show. Thank you. It brings back some memories for me because I was serving in the legislature in 2010 when we had a bill on this subject. And I co-sponsored that bill and toured the special management unit at Warren and got a close-up look at it. And it was disturbing to me that the bill was not that well received. And when the commissioner at the time told legislators that cutting back on solitary would make the prison much more dangerous, the legislators, a vast majority of them, fell in line and voted down the bill. Although they did create a task force. We did create a task force, and that helped start to make the changes. But it seemed so obvious to me at the time that solitary confinement was just inhumane, which is horribly so, but also ineffective. And I think the main experience now is showing that that's true, because eventually a new commissioner started making changes, and those have continued, and they're reflected apparently in the movie. And we're actually demonstrating that you can get better outcomes without using this horrible concept, this horrible method. And for some reason, I felt as though I had the ability to empathize and picture what it would be like to spend days and weeks and months in solitary. And I don't see how it doesn't break down an ordinary person, no less someone who's had challenges in their life. So I thank you, and I thank the people that have been involved in making these changes for the fact that Maine is becoming a positive story on this issue.
Go ahead, Joseph.
Yes, I agree. Definitely. We have definitely made steps in the right direction as far as the use of solitary confinement, but I think we have to take farther steps. And there was a lot of resistance in the beginning, is what I was noting. They had to come from the outside, these changes. And so a lot of the changes, as changes, must also come from the outside.
Ryan, listening to what John says, you can understand how 7 years ago there would be fear within the staff of the prison that if we do away with this, we will be in danger. How did you go about changing the minds of staff and making them feel as though they would not be endangered? The prison would not be more dangerous if we reduce solitary confinement.
It's a great point and a great question, and it's certainly something that has taken us, probably taking the most effort in, you know, the last 20 to 24 months. I will say the staff that we have at Maine State Prison do an excellent job adapting to change, and they've shown that across the last 18 to 24 months in this effort. What it has really taken is ongoing education and communication with them from the top, from the warden all the way down, explaining what the research is behind this, why we're doing this, showing them indications of success every chance we get, and really including them in decision making along the way. So, correctional officers have the ability to impact a prisoner's immediate life right when a behavior happens. And we bring the correctional officers into the decision-making process, whether they are removing them from a general population environment or making a decision to transition somebody back out to general population. And so it's really about communication and sharing of information and education. And I will credit Warden Liberty as being on the forefront of that on a day-to-day basis at the prison, being the person who spreads that message from his leadership team all the way down.
Is there a change in education if I study corrections at a community college? Am I going to learn things differently than I would have just 5 years ago?
I certainly think so. And I certainly hope you would. If you look at the topics of criminal justice and corrections conferences nationwide and trainings for professional development, the content area has drastically changed just in my short 13 years in the corrections environment. Thinking back to what my education was and what I've done for professional development, the entire content and subject matter has changed, whether it's restrictive housing, substance abuse, and so forth.
Joseph, are you asked to speak at some of these schools?
So, yes, I'm asked to speak at some of the schools. So, yes, they are reaching out and speaking to advocates and listening to advocates' voices about and people, former prisoners' voices about what their experiences are. And so, yes, I think it's very important that I speak to them and that others like me speak to them so that way they can get a general sense of how we're going to make change starting with them and when they go in and what they're going to see and how they're going to make it better. And so, yeah, I do talk a lot.
John, thanks so much for calling. We'll try to go to one more call before the break. Also, Bill in Portland. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Bill, are you there? Shoot, I'm sorry. Looks like we missed Bill. We'll go to Machias and Melanie. Hi, Melanie. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the content of some of the programming in solitary. Presumably, people are removed from general circulation because they're having trouble being safe and being helpful and resolving conflicts and self-regulating. And I'm wondering if while in solitary, there's a concerted effort and some programming to specifically address self-regulation and conflict management, the social and emotional skills that people really need to function both in the general population and then after release to the larger community. I can take my answer off the air.
Right?
Yes, so we really bring a multidisciplinary approach to every inmate that's in restrictive housing. So it really depends on the inmate that shows up in there and what their needs are. So the programming ranges from very individualized mental health treatment on a one-to-one basis, all the way to cognitive behavioral treatment that happens in more of a process group dynamic. We also offer in-cell programming that gets to mindfulness and some of that self-regulation that she spoke of. So we offer a wide array, and we're constantly adding to that based upon the prisoner demographic that shows up in restrictive housing.
Thanks for your call, Melanie. We do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Bob Mankoff has edited the New Yorker's cartoons for two decades.
My targets are either myself or people like me. I don't punch down. I don't punch up. I elbow to the side.
Next month, he steps aside, but he says he's not done with humor for good. I'm Audie Cornish, The New Yorker's Bob Mankoff, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
8 years ago, here's how a Massachusetts man felt about Obamacare.
You're forcing something down my throat, and then you're penalizing me because I can't afford it.
Now, here's how he feels about attempts to repeal it.
Here I'm thinking, great, I got insurance, and now you want to yank the rug right out from underneath me?
On Next, we'll tackle the confusing and contradictory world of healthcare, from politics to overcoming trauma to the language of addiction. I hope you can join us.
Tune in to Next coming up in about 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Solitary Confinement. In the studio with me, Ryan Thornell. He is Associate Commissioner of the Maine Department of Corrections. And Joseph Jackson is a former prisoner and now coordinator of Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. Join our conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Joseph, in your view, what are some options, some alternatives to solitary confinement for prisoners who may be, at risk of harming themselves or others?
Difficult question. So I think that there are some things that the department is doing. It's like near solitary, but I think there has to be some use. I agree with him when he says that statistically a very small amount of people are going to fall into that category. I think what happens is that after that de-escalation period and a shorter period of time sets in, that really solitary confinement is no longer needed, even though they might be in a restrictive unit. That's a much different thing. So you can put a person in a restricted unit, but that does not necessarily mean that they have to be in their cell locked in by themselves all day once that de-escalation period has exhausted itself, however long that may take, because with different people it's different. So yes, that's one, but the department has also moved away from, they're doing a thing now where we talk about we have less solitary confinement, but we have a thing where it's near solitary confinement, and that their special living unit is where they have this programming, what he mentioned earlier, for prisoners to step down to get back into general population. One of the things about that, it starts out when they begin as in like a solitary type environment where they are stripped of all of those things, and then they begin to earn those things back. The problem the advocates have with that is that this entire thing is based on punishment. So punishment lies at its foundation. We've been working to create an environment inside the institution that is rehabilitative based on rewards. And we think that you will get a much better bang for your buck, especially when it comes to altering behavior, when you begin to reward people for the things, for desire behavior, versus punishing them for it. And so I gave him the example that it's kind of hard to ask someone to be healed in an environment where, if I took a patient to a hospital and that hospital was dirty, I couldn't perform surgery on him and expect him to get better. So the environment first has to change before we really begin to think about healing people.
So I certainly agree with the mindset that we need to have incentive-based opportunities for prisoners if we expect behavioral change, and that's what we've witnessed in our restrictive housing environment. In fact, the corrections research tells us that for every one negative sanction, you need really four or more positive rewards or incentives in order to continue correcting and rehabilitating a prisoner. And so, you know, corrections in general struggles with that because you're constantly in an environment where there's negativity and negative sanctions. And so I agree with him on that. We've created a structured living unit that, you know, we hope curbs people from going into a restrictive housing environment so that if their behavior starts going in a direction where it looks like they may need to be removed from general population, we can put them into a program-intensive unit where they receive in-cell and out-of-cell programming, but in a very structured manner. So almost every hour of their day is taken up by something. And what Joe speaks to is an orientation process into that unit where they are locked down for a period of time as we assess what their behavior is, we get to know them and so forth. But so I certainly agree with his logic, and I certainly would say we are constantly looking at what our programming it is, how we respond to inmate behaviors, and we're always trying to improve because we know we're not going to ever be perfect.
Yeah, and I want to add, this is just land at the feet of the Department of Corrections because sometimes they don't have the tools to be able to offer that environment, to be able to offer those incentives. And so this is a time for when outside pressure, public pressure, and legislation has to be, get involved to be able to create this environment that is needed. It does not currently exist.
We're going to go to Lori, who's calling from Oxford. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer, for this topic. Years ago, I worked on a forensics unit out in the community for elderly residents who had health issues, who were still quite dangerous, and they were in a special unit in my nursing home. And the way we handled situations is we had adequate staffing, and the other simple thing that was necessary was a positive attitude. These people, some were not guilty by reason of insanity. Some were actually very dangerous, but we didn't treat them like criminals. And speaking for me, I've been to jail for an addictions-related offense. I actually turned myself in. And after I was through, I was in for 48 hours. My attitude toward law enforcement changed. I began to feel that I couldn't receive justice. And I later straightened that out, but you've got a choice. If you put someone in solitary and demonize them or dehumanize them, you can have safety in the prison, or you can, but you will have danger when they are released, because solitary confinement makes it, I wasn't confined that way. Overall, I think the main thing is the attitude of the American public that not only should prisoners be punished, but they should be stigmatized for life.
Lori, thank you so much for calling and sharing your thoughts. And I want to go back to something she said at the very beginning, and that's having the resources. Do you have the resources you need, Ryan, to implement these changes?
Well, we certainly make the most of the resources that we have. And I think that, our outcomes, at least at this point, show that the resources that we're utilizing are effective and are resulting in what we want to have happen, which is a safer prison and a more rehabilitative environment. Certainly, as we explore new ideas, we certainly look for additional resources to bring those about. For example, additional trainings and professional development for staff so that they feel like they have the necessary tools to continue the work that we're doing in these specialty units out in general population. So it's a long way of saying, yes, I think we have the resources at our disposal. We do a good job of making use of, a finite number of resources, and we have a commissioner who supports us deploying our resources into these key areas and away from punishment-oriented areas.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. We're going to move on to Lisa in Camden. Lisa, our time is tight, so if you could be fairly brief, that would be great.
Hi. I was a nurse at Maine State Prison from 01 to 05, starting in Thomaston and then moving to Warren. So I had quite an exposure to inmates in solitary. And one of the things that I found truly astonishing was not only how dehumanizing it was and how it could lead to this devastating decomposition, but the inmates had complete personality changes from when they were in the gen pop to when they were in solitary. And being a nurse, most of our self-harm, our cutters, would come from solitary. And also, I see this as a further breakdown in attachment issues. And when inmates are in solitary, they lose their social competency or whatever social competency they had.
Lisa, I'm guessing that you applaud the changes that you're hearing about.
I am thrilled to hear it. I mean, it just broke my heart. It really did to know an inmate in Gen Pop and then to go and take care of them in solitary. And it's just completely dehumanizing. And I'm thrilled to hear. And Joseph, you know, right on. Good for you. And I'm glad you're out and doing well.
Lisa, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. I think I can squeeze in one more call. We're going to go to Michael in Lewiston. Michael, hi. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to tell my brother's story. He struggled with severe mental illness for over 20 years. He was a consent decree class member from AmHi, and he was incarcerated in 2005, 2007. 6 months of that time in prison was in solitary confinement. And the stories he told me when he got out, the brutalizing manner, you know, the guards would put on riot gear and create this mass of bodies and push him in the corner of his cell. You know, he didn't have a pillow or toilet paper for that time. I mean, it was just, you know, just horrifying to hear. And in 2012, he was in house arrest for another crime that he committed. And during that period of waiting for his trial, he killed himself instead of going back to prison from that previous experience. And the other point that I wanted to just make, you know, in discharge, the only plan they had was to give him, you know, $20 or $25 and drop him off at the homeless shelter in his hometown.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing the story, and I'm so sorry to hear of your brother's death. Unfortunately, we're right at the end of the program and probably could talk another hour about this, but as you hear this story, Joseph, you're not surprised.
No, and I'm saying that we're not in agreement as far as the results are concerned. While the results of solitary confinement being reduced are great, the numbers of people recidivating are not, and especially when you look out 3 years, and especially in juveniles in 1 year. So we definitely have a lot of work to do.
We certainly have a lot of work to do, but I will say that we are very proud of the work that we're currently doing and the effort and the momentum we have in a very positive and progressive direction. And I think that I'm confident in saying that a lot of what you'll see in the film and some of the stories we've heard about poor past, you know, those are the days of the past, and we're in a completely different direction at the department.
Michael, thank you for your call, and thank you both for being here on the program. Joseph Jackson, a former prisoner and now coordinator for the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition, and Ryan Thornell, Associate Commissioner of the Maine Department of Corrections. Earlier in the program, we heard from Dan Edge, the producer of the Frontline documentary, Last Days of Solitude, which you can watch on Maine Public Television next Tuesday, April 18th. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can always find our programs at mainecalling.net. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.